Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Instead of talking about who won and who lost, we're talking about who has a job and who does not. As an example, Jay Gruden still does not have a job, but Ron Rivera does. Riverboat Ron is taking over in Washington and reportedly bringing Jack Del Rio with him as defensive coordinator. Personally, I like that hire. In fact, I like it a lot. And I like that he's bringing Jack Del Rio with him even more. So that's a good place to start. Freddie Kitchens is out in Cleveland. So is John Dorsey, which means Cleveland is going to go with a hard reset yet again. Now, if you want to make a move at head coach after this season, that's fine. I get that. In fact, I will own everything I said about the Browns coming into the season and during the season. Yes, I was all in on them coming into the year. Yes, I was all in on Freddie Kitchens getting that gig based on how the offense and Baker Mayfield responded in the second half of last season. And no, I've got no problem with the Browns breaking him off after only one season. Because while it's not on him, all on him, that one season was enough of a catastrophe, and my man Freddie was in over his head. He was. So firing the coach, to me, is justifiable in that spot. But firing the coach is one thing. Firing the coach and the GM, though, is another. If you're doing that, you're effectively starting over again. So you better have a plan, and it better be a really good plan, and not just you flailing around again. This is still a Browns house, despite that disastrous season they just had. But don't jack it up. Don't jack it up this time. I know the Haslams want to win. They just don't know how to win. Hopefully, they do get it right this time. Meantime, the Panthers are still looking for a head coach. The Jags are not. Now, to the surprise of many, Doug Marrone is coming back again next year, which means they're putting all the blame for the past 2 years on Tom Coughlin. To me, either that's a really bold strategy or it is no strategy at all. So, Jacksonville does not have an opening, but you know who also doesn't? Dallas. Hell yes. The Dallas Cowboys still have Jason Garrett as their head coach. New year, new you, but not a new head coach. That is absolutely the best. The organization that could not stop talking about their head coaching position has a chance to make a move right now because the season's over and they still haven't done anything at all. Like Jarrah. Jarrah went from nonstop noise about his head coach, providing weekly updates on his job status, to doing absolutely nothing when the time came to do something. Well, actually, I take that back. That's not right. Jarrah has done something. Jason Garrett reportedly met with Jarrah and Stephen Jones on Monday, and then again on Tuesday, and now he's coming back to meet for a third time today. A third meeting. Like, are you kidding me? I love that they're meeting again, and they're really dragging this thing out. Except, what the hell is there to talk about now that they haven't already talked about before? What's changed since Tuesday? Like, yo, Red, what did you have for dinner last night? Come in and talk to me and Steven about it. Hey, how are those New Year's resolutions going for you, Red Man? Hey, you see that Rose Bowl? Hell of a game, right? Honestly, this is the best. Just when you thought Jarrah could not get any more Jarrah than he was during the regular season, he finds a new gear in January. I respect that because that's what the great ones always do. January is where legends are made in the NFL, and Jerry Jones is becoming more of a legend every single day. My only hope is they don't make an announcement today. Stretch this thing out. His contract runs up until January 14th, but don't stop there. Keep it going right past the Super Bowl, right into the combine, right past the combine, right past the draft. I want Jarrah and Steven and Red to still be meeting 3 or 4 times a week in July to talk about Red's job. That would be the greatest thing ever. And it's even better when you hear the reports that Garrett already has allegedly said his goodbyes. And they're still dragging this guy back to the facility for nearly daily meetings. I mean, you hear those reports. He said his goodbyes. He packed up his desk. He walked out of a building. He had a cardboard box. He had an office plant on top of it. And Jarrah saying, hey, yo, Red, can you come back in tomorrow for another meeting? It's amazing. I can't wait to see how today's meeting goes and how it compares to the other two meetings. But again, seriously, what the hell is this all about? They can't really be deciding whether or not they're going to keep this guy, right? There's no way he could actually come back, right? Then again, how many times has the world said that Jason Garrett is going to get broken off on Sunday? And sure enough, that key card still works on Monday. And then he's right back at it, doing whatever the hell it is that he does. So, is this yet another long line of burials for Garrett that never actually takes place? Or are they going to try to make him like head coach emeritus or something like that? I don't know, maybe like clapper in chief.
The clapper.
Just keep that guy around. Or is it possible that the Cowboys don't even have a replacement in mind? I mean, that can't be right. You can't tell me that with all the gum flapping about head coaches that Jerry Jones has done over the years, that this guy doesn't actually have a short list ready? Or is this about, and this is one of my favorite angles, is it about keeping Garrett away from some other team, like a team in the division that has an opening, which I will get to in just a moment? But what's that about? I mean, are they trying to keep Garrett long enough for everybody else to make their moves so that Garrett can't come back and coach against him? Because if they're doing that, that's pretty weird and pretty much dirty pool. Like, if you think this guy is so good that he could turn around another team, then you would keep him as your own head coach. But if you don't want the guy as your head coach, it's because you think that he can't or that you can do better. So go do better and let this guy go do his thing someplace else. In other words, does Jarrah not have a plan, or does Jarrah have an amazing plan? Knowing Jarrah and his crew, anything is possible. Just know this. Know this about me. I love this. I love the fact that Jerry Jones, a guy who can't wait to talk to the media moments after a game and has weekly radio hits, is suddenly nowhere to be found. And the organization that's talked so much for so long suddenly has gone silent. The only bad thing here is if it ends today. Man, don't let this thing end today. Keep meeting and keep deciding nothing. Oh, and keep missing the playoffs when you're an alleged Super Bowl contender. In other words, never ever change. And I know you won't. Cowboy honks, I haven't checked in with y'all in a couple weeks. Where you at? What's going on? I just know this is exactly what you wanted, right? Or actually the complete opposite of what you wanted. Because the red man still got a job. He is Jason Lockenfora, JLC. Happy New Year, brother. How are you?
Happy New Year to you. Hope all is well. And just one small editorial note. The NFL today will be on Saturday night.
There you go. Very good
point.
There
we go. We're in basically prime time with us having the Patriots-Titans game.
So. I love it. Awesome.
See
Can't wait for that.
Afternoon.
Good. Good point. All right, so it's January 2nd. Jason, does Jason Garrett still have a job on January 2nd?
The world's longest bro hug continues. I think, what are we in, the day three or day four? I don't know if anybody from the Guinness Book of World Records is down there in the Dallas-Arlington area keeping track of this. It's amazing. I can't see how Jason Garrett comes out of this with the job he had before. Now, does he have some other job? Do they concoct something for him that keeps him in Jerry's orbit and keeps him in the family, and sort of gives Jason enough to do that it's not just, you know what I mean, shaking hands like a casino greeter, but obviously it's not going to be what he did before. I that's what I'm led to believe they've been sort of pouring over and churning over. Will there be enough for Jason Garrett, to feel fulfilled to some degree? Or would he take a year off and you know, cast his lot as a head coach somewhere else? I don't see him getting one of these jobs. This is a very tight market. But, you know, a year from now or whatever, after a reset, could he reinvent himself? That's what they're sorting through. I still, again, can't imagine, you know what I mean, Jerry popping out of that room today or tomorrow and, you know what I mean, and waving a new 5-year contract for Jason Garrett to be the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys.
I don't know, in terms of this bro hug that you mentioned, I'm loving it. I hope it never, ever ends, but all good things do come to an end. I'm sure this will.
Dominating a news cycle on an entire week where there's all this crazy stuff happening in the league, and they've literally done nothing, and it's still Cowboys, Cowboys, Cowboys. I mean, from a marketing standpoint, Jerry obviously is a genius.
He's doing what he does, and he's doing it very well. But assuming they move on, and they ultimately will, who are the guys they would be looking at to replace Garrett?
I mean, I've heard since before the season started that Jerry was a big fan of what, you know, Lincoln Riley was doing in Oklahoma and was, in, you know, sort of intrigued by that. You know, I don't know why they wouldn't want to talk to Matt Rhule right down the road at Baylor. Everybody else does. And to me, the wild card in this is Mike Zimmer, because I continue to hear that if the Vikings do not show well against the Saints, that all the changes that they kind of figured were looming in 2021, well, maybe we make them in 2020, because there's not that many teams looking for coaches right now. And if we don't think he's the right guy to try to salvage the last year of this Kirk Cousins contract and get this team, you know, from being good to truly great, then maybe you make the move. And if everybody wants to talk to our offensive coordinator, Kevin Stefanski, maybe he's worth talking to for us, too. And if we're talking to Stefanski, why don't we talk to everybody? So, and if Zimmer is out, Jerry loves him, and he is part of the family. And whether it's Zimmer running Lincoln Riley's defense in the sort of Sean McVay, Wade Phillips model, or whether it's Zimmer as a head coach, I think Jerry would have some interest in Zimmer.
Jason, looking forward to joining us. I'm glad you mentioned the Vikings and Zimmer. I was going to ask you about them. All right, Jason, what about the Giants? You know, you've got the Giants, and it was not that big of a surprise that Pat Shurmur was fired. But if you're a Giants fan, how are you feeling after seeing that press conference with Dave Gettleman?
Woo-wee. Tuesday, what a day, man. We had the Shad Khan statement that he's keeping a GM who's 36 and 76. We had Dave Gettleman trying to convince us that he's really a computer guy at heart, too, and he's at the forefront of modern analytics and football.
Right.
What a doozy. Bizarro world. Oh, yeah, and then the Browns fired their GM 24 hours after he fired their coach, and they had a statement from the GM who, you know, ostensibly was staying at that point. But, yeah, I mean, look, I don't think anybody's taking what the Giants sales pitch is seriously. You know, the idea that Gettleman is now put in this revolutionary analytics department, so he's got to stay. At least that's what ownership said. I don't know that that's being really looked at as like an alternative fact, I think, in the NFL world. But regardless, Gettleman is on board now. If they don't land Matt Rhule, I will be incredibly interested to see who they hire. They're casting a wide net. It's kind of all over the place. The other A-list guys do not want to work with Dave Gettleman. And Matt Rhule may not want to work with Dave Gettleman, or maybe I'll work with Gettleman, but in a completely sort of neutered, marginalized role. That's what they're going to have to sort through. But I do know returning to Jersey, coaching the Giants, has a unique appeal to Matt Rhule, and he by no means is shutting the door on NFL teams. if they don't get him, you know, Mike McCarthy's done the job, won some games. I would think experience would resonate there, and some success as an NFL or big-time college head coach would be something of a requirement, although, again, a lot of the guys they're talking to have nowhere close to that sort of resume.
Jason LaCanfora is an NFL insider for CBS Sports. He joins us once again. Jason, you mentioned the Browns, so let me ask you about that. They're going with a hard reset on everything once again. The coach is out. The GM is out. Is that a sign that they've got a plan, perhaps, for a new head coach who would not want to work with John Dorsey,
yeah,
or is that reading too much into it?
No, I think that's exactly what it is, that you know, they for about 2 days, they had three coaching searches going on. You had the owner, Jimmy Haslam, reaching out to people he knows personally, like Urban Meyer. You had Paul DePodesta and the rise of the supercomputers in that building. You know, hey, we loved Kevin Stefanski a year ago. Hey, there's some guys on the Niners staff we think would make sense. And then you had John Dorsey reaching out to people he knew, like Eric Bieniemy and Mike McCarthy. And you know, it became pretty clear early in the process that Jimmy Haslam wasn't necessarily just going to, you know, put a check next to whatever Dorsey said and go with his guy, and that there were going to be people who wanted to talk about front office structure. And so at that point, they made the move. Where does it end up? It depends. It's going to be Dee and Jimmy Haslam who are calling all the shots there. And if they meet some of these younger coaches, or in the case of McCarthy, a former NFL head coach, and they fall in love with him, so be it. But I firmly believe he'll be reaching out to some of these big fish and taking their temperature. I mean, this is a guy who almost traded for Jim Harbaugh not that long ago. So I would not rule out him making a splash. And if you're going after a dude like that, you better be willing to come to them with completely bare cupboard so they can fill it for you. Everything from the team nutritionist to the guy who drives the bus to the dude with the, you know, who clears the snow off the field. Like, they're going to make all the calls.
Jason Lock and Ford joining us for a few more moments. So in terms of those big fish, GLC, what about Josh McDaniels? Would he be considered that? And if he's coaching on Saturday night, what do you expect him to be doing on Sunday and Monday in terms of interviews?
Yeah, I mean, look, if they lose Saturday night, then he's going to obviously be able to spend a lot of time with whichever teams he chooses. If they win, history would tell us that Bill Belichick will go by the letter of the law, and he will give McDaniels the shortest portals of time that he has to allot in a short work week for the Patriots, which is understandable. And Josh may have to be a little bit judicious because it's hard to glean a lot out of a 2 or 3 hour interview. It just is. But would he have worked with Dorsey? No, I don't think that would have worked. I don't think anybody would have thought that would have worked. So, yeah, I think it's realistic. They really wanted him in the past, and it didn't seem like a good fit. Last year, they didn't talk to him when it would have made a lot of sense, too. And now it looks like they will sit down again. He's from that area. You know, that can kind of cut both ways. If you're the guy to save the Browns and you're from, you know, Ohio, that's a special thing. But, you know, when you have all the friends and family there and if things aren't going so great, it can be really, really, really tough to be in your hometown as well. So we'll see. Carolina will have a lot of interest for Josh. I don't know that he and Gettleman are a fit. In fact, I can't imagine they are. But we'll see, you know, what develops with the Giants and if Gettleman's role evolves at all.
All right, so let me double back to one last thing before I let you go that you brought up, Jacksonville. So Jacksonville, let's go with Tom Coughlin a few weeks back, but they decide to stay with Doug Marrone for 2020. What do you think is the thinking behind that decision?
I don't. I wrote a column on it a few days ago. If you look at him from any sort of standard metric, results on the field, results in your own division, did we finish strong or did we hobble in? Next year's contracts, next year's salary caps, our roster versus the other rosters in the division. And then history. Okay, now first-round picks more important than ever, right? We made the Jalen Ramsey trade. We traded our best player for two, you know, bites at a future apple. Well, they've been picking bad apples. I mean, and they've been drafting real high and coming away with nothing. And, I mean, Dave Caldwell's a great dude, and I think he's very smart and very sharp. But he's been there since 2013, and they've won 36 games. This year was a disaster, right? The owner said it was a disaster himself in the press release. Well, guess what? It was their second-best season under Dave Caldwell. So I don't get it. There are people who feel like maybe they are just streamlining things, keeping costs down, and waiting to see how many games they play in London in this new CBA. And maybe eventually the whole Jacksonville experiment might not work for Shad Khan. I don't know. That's how people in the league are reading it. But regardless, from a business or financial standpoint or a results standpoint in the standings, 36-76. Woo!
Dear Romy, I don't want to talk about JLC. I want to talk about the Rose Bowl. What were you doing there? Regards, Geoff and Lincoln.
There? What were you doing there?
It's not that far from where I live. I live in Southern California. They play that game in Southern California. It was one of the best matchups of the bowl season. And the Wisconsin contingency was there. So as you probably know, our oldest son, Jake, started at UW, University of Wisconsin at Madison, and just wrapped up his first semester there. The Badgers made it back to the Rose Bowl. They had lost 3 straight. So, of course, we wanted to be there and take that all in and had a great time. So why don't we talk about the bowl games really quickly? There was a time when New Year's Day was an absolute bowl extravaganza. It's not like that anymore. In fact, it really hasn't been like that for a while. But I am not going to go old guy, get the hell off my lawn about it. Not when yesterday did involve a trip to the Rose Bowl, the actual bowl. And it was pretty awesome. There's a reason why the Rose Bowl is special. In fact, there's a lot of reasons why. Yesterday lived up to all of the reasons. Wisconsin, Oregon, being in the building. I talked at length with Badgers icon and former NFLer Pat Richter. Man, you talk about a living legend. My man was awesome. Pat Richter, so much class, such a dignified guy, and stories. Stories for days. Not that Richter. Pat Richter. you know, the guy responsible for hiring Barry Alvarez, the guy responsible for hiring a couple of coaches, not one but two, who got the basketball team in the Final Four. The guy who turned it all around for the University of Wisconsin, sports-wise. And then there was the game itself. And as you know, I do not root. I just don't. But that was a great game. That was a great game that had a horrible call at the end. You know what I'm talking about here. Oregon leading late in the fourth quarter, 28-27. Wisconsin had the ball. Third and six at their own 28. Enormous play. A first down keeps that drive going. A stop pretty much ends that game right there. So go ahead and roll it.
Cone delivers quickly. Catch made. And it is Ferguson, the tight end. A flag comes in the secondary.
Lenore, I guess he pushes at the top of his route. You can see Paul Chris, boy. You're not going to see a motion very much from Paul Chris, but on a critical third down.
Yeah, you got to use your imagination to see that as a pick.
All right, so that was a truly terrible call, period. That was a terrible call. That's not some homer or some badger honk saying that. There was a lot of people saying that, not just me, including Sunday Night Football rules analyst Terry McCauley tweeting it. He tweeted, quote, "That is not OPI against Wisconsin. The receiver is trying to get into his route. The defender grabs him and prevents him from releasing. Hashtag Oregon versus Wisconsin." So what that was a terrible call at a terrible time, period. But Badger fan, as much as you hate to hear this, no, that is not what cost you that game. The four turnovers is what cost you that game. The four turnovers, which led to Oregon scoring 21 points. Justin Herbert coming up with one clutch play after another. That's what cost you the game. The officials did not beat you. Oregon did. And I hate to say it, but you beat yourselves by not taking care of the football, by committing too many costly penalties. Those turnovers do not change the fact that that was a brutal call. Nor do they change the fact that somehow, some way, officiating seems to be getting worse by the game. Look, I understand the bad calls are always going to happen, but how are they happening so often? Is it too much to ask that we get through a single game, any big game, without a ridiculously horrible call? Can we do that in any game at any level, college or pro? It feels like that might be too much to ask. It feels like it might be too much to ask. Except that's not the reason they lost that game. It just was a really bad call at a really bad time that once again became a talking point. But they had their chances. You got to take care of the football. And they had too many costly penalties. And you got to tip your hat to Oregon. They got it done. They found a way. Wisconsin did not find a way. So that's a gut-wrenching loss. Right when they thought they had it on the big stage and they were going to reverse that trend at the Rose Bowl. But it didn't happen. Great experience, though. Great, great atmosphere. Great experience. And, man, there was a sea of red. Badger Nation definitely represented. And they were devastated walking out of that joint. 1-800-636-8686. In terms of the officiating, I mean, it's getting worse, not better. Is it too much to ask that we play a big game and not have the officials as a talking point after that game? It feels like that might be too much to ask. You know, like it might be too much to ask to have Michigan show up in a big game away from the big house. That clearly is too much to ask. He is Pete Thamel. Pete, it is great to have you on the show. How are you?
Jim, always great to be in the jungle. Appreciate you having me, man.
Pete, great to have you back. Thanks so much. Happy New Year. So let me start with the Rose Bowl. Pete, Oregon beat Wisconsin in the Rose Bowl last night, thanks in large part to a big game from Justin Herbert. So let me start right there. You had a great piece on him back in August. For those who do not know him, how would you describe him?
Yeah, Justin Herbert's really one of the more interesting kids I've run across in the years I've done this, Jim. He is super bright, and if he didn't happen to be a top 10 NFL draft pick, he would have gone on and been a doctor. He's from a family of biologists and grew up sort of entranced by science and enjoyed science so much, he actually became a biology TA for the hardest bio class at Oregon. Two years ago, if you were having trouble with Stimlata or something you and I probably would have trouble with in college, when you walked in, the guy who was give you help would be Justin Herbert, who was the starting quarterback for the Ducks. And part of the reason he came back this year, he'd have been the first quarterback pick last year. I really believe. Again, philosophically, maybe Murray would have fit with the Cardinals done better, but he would have been the would have been the top guy on most NFL teams' boards. And he came back to finish his degree. And because the moment that happened on the field after the Rose Bowl yesterday meant so much to him. You know, he grew up a Ducks fan. The team hotel where they stay the night before games, you can actually see from his family kitchen if you look out the window. So he's a Eugene kid through and through, grew up going to games. So it was a really neat moment for him last night. His brother's on the team there, his younger brother, and, you know, his dad's a lifetime Duck fan. So it was really fun. The Herberts are good people. It was fun to see them have that moment and for a kid to go back and his stock to stay really high, and obviously to avoid injury was a really storybook finish.
And he played Big Pete, and that paid off. So that was a really good story right there. Pete Thamel joining us. Pete, if we were to go back to Saturday and LSU-Oklahoma, given all the hype surrounding Joe Burrow, it seemed like it would be impossible for him to exceed that hype. And then he goes out and he throws for 7 touchdowns in the first half. What did you make of his performance?
Yeah, I mean, Jim, like, this will sound like hyperbole, but I don't know if anyone in college football history has had a better season, single season, than Joe Burrow is having right now. I really think that's like he's won Heisman by a couple metrics, by more than anyone's won the Heisman. So amongst Heisman winners, you can already consider him one of the best in history. And then he goes out and outperforms that outlandish standard that he set for himself. Now, look, I thought LSU would blow out Oklahoma. Did I think they'd score 49 in the first half and Joe Burrow would throw 7 touchdown passes? No. I mean, that's cartoonish. That's what you do to a directional bye game, you know, the second week in September. It's really astounding what he's been able to accomplish. And look, he's done it against Florida and he did it against Texas A&M, and Auburn is the only team that for about a half kind of stymied LSU, and they adjusted and went on from there and went on to win. Georgia played an entirely different defense against them, and it didn't matter. They went out and rolled them. So I was in the moment in awe, but yet again, like, we should probably stop being surprised by Joe Burrow and Joe Brady at this point.
We're talking to Pete Thamel. All right, so if he completes nearly 75% of his passes, had maybe as good a year as anybody's ever had, he had more than 500 total yards in that game and 8 touchdowns. If you're Clemson, Pete, how do you go about trying to stop him?
Yeah, it's the great riddle and the great mystery of this season. Look, if anyone can do it, it's Brent Venables, the veteran Clemson defensive coordinator who has been on this stage, be it at Clemson or at Oklahoma in prior years, many, many times. And they have a really good back 7. Dabo Sweeney said all year that he thinks the back 7 could be the best that they've had this year. What they don't have is a good front that's going to be able to pressure the quarterback. And the first step to beating Burrow is you got to make him uncomfortable, move him, and maybe rattle him, maybe strip sack him, something like that. And I don't know if Clemson has the personnel up front to do that. That said, Venables called some really cagey blitzes against Ohio State and found creative ways to get pressure on Justin Fields. Fields threw 2 interceptions, which was one more than he'd thrown all year, and he probably should have thrown 4. So I think that 16 days to prepare for Brent Venables is a good thing if you're Clemson, and that back end is going to have to be high end in their coverage.
We're talking to Pete Thamel. Now, Pete, speaking of Ohio State, if you go back to that game, with 5 minutes left in the third quarter, Ohio State had the Jordan 4 fumble return for a TD taken off the board. What did you make of that ruling, and then what did people around the Ohio State program make of that ruling?
Well, I think it was pretty universal in the officiating community that I thought it was a coin flip call. And if it had been called the other way on the field, you couldn't have reversed it to a touchdown. Well, actually, you couldn't have done that because they would have ruled it down. But to me, there was not enough evidence to overturn it. But I can't say that sitting there in the press box, I was talking to Pat Forty, my old colleague, and I was like, look, I'm kind of like, I'm not standing on the table about this. I was like, I'm kind of wishy-washy about it. But if you feel that way about a call and, you know, you slow it down, you can see it from different angles. There's the whole fast replay versus, you know, game speed kind of thing. I don't think there was enough there to overturn it. Really smart officiating people that I respect echoed those comments. And the reaction out of Ohio State was pretty significant. Gene Smith, the athletic director, texted me that he was pissed about the call. And look, I think they have the right to be pissed. If they upheld the call, I don't think you would have heard the same outcry from the Clemson side.
So, like, top to bottom, though, it seems like you have a competitive game. We can't have a competitive game without there being some sort of high-profile officiating situation, including the Rose Bowl. So what do you make of the officiating in the Clemson-Ohio State game and the state of officiating overall?
Well, I do think social media and just the preponderance or the glut of different replays, different angles, different ways, you know, puts it all under a ton more scrutiny. It wasn't that long ago we didn't have replay. So the J.K. Dobbins catch would have been a touchdown. I mean, replay definitely played a big factor. And typically, like, I'm not a big point at the officials guy. Like, typically they get it right. You know, those guys are good at their jobs. They're professionals. They take it very seriously. But in that, certainly in that case in the Ohio State Clemson game, there was some room to second guess. And all the replays, all the angles, all the clips live on in social media. Imagine, like, what was it, the 85 World Series with the play at first? Imagine if that happened in this era right now. You know, but it wouldn't have, because we have a replay, you know? So, there's a lot to unpack from that Ohio State game. They had certainly had opportunities to win the game. But you can understand and sympathize with the coaches and administrators there who feel like that moment got pulled from them and had a big impact in the game.
No doubt. Pete Thamel joining us for a few more moments. So, Pete, what about Trevor Lawrence? He had taken some heat earlier in the season, but as you point out, he is 25-0 as a starter. And against Ohio State, he threw for more than 250 yards. He rushed for more than 100, including that 67-yarder. So what did he show you and how he handled that game?
Well, he showed guts. I mean, he showed straight up guts. They didn't have a lot going, and the defensive line of Ohio State was mauling Clemson's front. And I mean, I think he had 15 carries, and ETN only had about 10. So they basically knew that running the quarterback was one of the only chances they had. And Trevor Lawrence put that team on his shoulders. I give him a ton of credit. He played a monster game. And I think that when I talk to coaches who played them in those first six or seven games, when he had his quote unquote struggles, I mean, we all struggle like Trevor, right? They just thought he was pressing. They thought he might have been overconfident in his arm. I still think he's a transcendent quarterback prospect. I still think highly of him. And he just, you know, when we really learn about quarterbacks is when the games are on the line in postseason type situations, right? And I think we learned a ton about Trevor Lawrence in that game. He was gutsy. There wasn't a lot there. He made plays, and Clemson figured it out.
All right, so it seems pretty obvious, Pete, that Clemson's biggest concern when facing LSU is going to be Joe Burrow. What is LSU's biggest concern when it comes to facing Clemson?
I would think it would be – LSU's defense has just been okay. You know, like at this point in the year when you're dealing with teams this high end, you're dealing with best on best, right? I think Clemson had the top three defense and top three offense and scoring defense and offense in the country. LSU showed some vulnerability. Now, some of that is because of possessions, because they've scored so darn fast, right? Like, you know, they're gonna end up giving up more points, and they're gonna end up giving up a lot of passing yards because teams are trying to come back against them. But that said, like, there's no Glenn Dorsey on the defensive line. They do have some nice pieces in the secondary, especially Stingley, who's had one of the most remarkable freshman years at corner that I can remember. But I don't think they're, like, overly talented. So it would just be generally stopping Lawrence, stopping ETN, because they don't have the horses up front. Certainly they are not comparable on the defensive front to Ohio State. So can ETN really kind of have a monster game, control the game, keep the ball away from Burrow? And look, the collection of receivers in this game, Jim, I mean – you have the two quarterbacks who are going to be the number one pick in the next two drafts, and then the collection of receivers, we're probably going to see five guys picked in the first two rounds of the next two drafts, at least, at the receiver position on both these teams. So there's going to be some tall tasks for the DBs, and I think it's going to be a little bit of who can slow who down.
We're talking to Pete Thamel. You know, Pete, one last thought, too. We're in the middle of this 16-day stretch between the semifinals and the championship game. Like, how weird is this stretch, and how did it come to be in the first place?
It's very weird, and I wrote a column about this on Yahoo a couple weeks ago, that it basically they tried that horribly failed experiment to put the games on New Year's Eve, and they thought people would stop going out to parties and going to bars and stuff and watch 8 hours of football, and that was a abject failure. So this game was supposed to be on New Year's Eve, but when they recognized that mistake, they moved it to the 28th. And basically they want the game on a Monday. So when the game was originally scheduled, and I feel like this is like one of those math problems, like when a train leaves Houston, you know,
right.
in junior high. When the game was originally scheduled, they couldn't schedule it for the immediate Monday after because there wasn't a 7-day break. And so it was scheduled for what it couldn't be scheduled on the 6th. It had to be scheduled on the 13th. And then when they moved the game back, what would have been like a 12-13 day gap all of a sudden now becomes the 16-day gap. So it was sort of the failings of the college football playoff to recognize that New Year's mistake, and then compensating for it leaves this kind of awkward gap. And it's kind of funny, like when there's 2 weeks gap in the Super Bowl, which used to happen, Jim, like there's, you know, you talk about the Super Bowl for 2 weeks. Here there's like, you know, 18 games in between. There's NFL play. There's 3 weeks of NFL that people are going to have to digest. So I think it's an awesome matchup, and I'm fired up for it. It'd be interesting to see the focus it gets over the next couple of weeks because there's so much distracting people from this game.
I said, is it too much to ask that we have a big game on any level and a competitive matchup and without the officiating being a talking point? It feels like at this point, it's just too much to ask. You know, like it might be too much to ask for Michigan to show up in a big game away from the big house. Going into yesterday's Citrus Bowl, all the talk was about Michigan v. Alabama. Jim Harbaugh v. Nick Saban. Which team was going to show up with more fire and more passion? Bama, normally about the championship, normally about the playoff. Were they going to show up with that kind of heat, that kind of fire? What about Michigan? Would they show up on the big stage and get it done? Finally, all these questions coming in. And on the opening kickoff, Michigan returns it 50 yards to midfield. So when your program has been questioned for consistently no-showing in huge games, and Michigan has, and rightfully so, all legitimate questions. When they show up like that, that's how you want to respond. That's how you want to start the game, with a statement, kickoff return, and then getting on the board immediately. Except that's not what they did. They started with the ball at midfield, then they go incomplete pass, two-yard run, incomplete pass, punt. And then on Alabama's first play from scrimmage, Bama did this.
He on a first down play, Bama's Jones, long, Judy, he's got it, touchdown Alabama! Oh my goodness, 85 yards on the first play from scrimmage for the Crimson Tide.
Uh-oh! Learfield, IMG on the call. 88 yards, 7-0 Bama. It looked like the beatdown was on. But to their credit, Michigan did not crumble. Michigan did not fold. They came back, they tied it up at 7, and then they took the lead 13-7. Then Alabama gets it back 14-13. Michigan hits a huge field goal to take a 16-14 lead going into halftime. So considering they come in as dogs, and they never show up when it matters, that's a really impressive showing from Michigan in the first half. Like, they ate that punch. They got up. They kept swinging. They even had the lead. They did not pack it in the first half. They didn't take. Or they didn't melt down when they got punched in the face. Nope. They didn't melt down when they got punched in the face. Instead, they saved it for the second half. Because on the fourth play from scrimmage in the second half, Bama did this to
play
them.
Play action fake to Najee. Mack throws long, looks near side. Devontae, he's got it. He's in. Touchdown, Alabama! 42 yards. The Tide is on top.
21-16, Alabama. And it only got worse from there. Alabama then made it 28-16. Then they get the ball back in the fourth quarter. All they needed to do was spin clock. All they needed to do was run out the clock, except that's not what they did. Instead, Bama drives at 73 yards down to the 2-yard line. And with less than a minute to go, instead of taking a knee, the Nicktator goes for the jugular.
Alabama gonna hand it off here, and Harris will score with 27 seconds to go.
Bam! Have some. Like, what was that all about? Was that payback for those comments about the camps a few years back? Was that just Nick Saban being Nick Saban? Was that Jim Harbaugh being Jim Harbaugh? Because the most amazing part of that sequence wasn't even Saban going for that touchdown with seconds to go. It was Harbaugh trying to return the favor by clocking the ball with 1 second left to take their own shot at the end zone. That was awesome. Watching his guy throw an interception into the end zone at the end of the game. I mean, the whole last sequence was so brutal for Michigan. A brutal way for Michigan to end the game and the season, but it was so typical and so predictable of Michigan under Harbaugh. And so were the complaints from Michigan about Bama running it up on them. Like, you know, a true Michigan man would never do something like that. Like, you had Michigan linebacker Cameron McGrone, who had some thoughts about that final TD. He said, quote, "It was kind of a smack in the face, but it is what it is. It's football. We've got to be ready all times, and we weren't ready for that play," end quote. See, the first part of that take was terrible. The second was better. You do have to be ready to play at all times, and that team was not ready in the second half. At least the offense wasn't, because the offense did nothing, outscored 21-0. And the offense is supposed to be where Harbaugh shines. He was brought in to be a quarterback whisperer. But the quarterback has been a huge problem ever since he arrived. His quarterback got outplayed by a backup in that game. And that's not a one-off either. Again, the quarterback position has been a problem since he got there. And so has competitiveness in big games. Michigan has now been outscored 91-43 the last two games. Getting hammered in a big game again. Like, we're getting to the point where it doesn't even feel real anymore. And is it really true that yesterday was Michigan's 16th straight loss to an AP top 15 team away from home? I mean, think about that stat for a minute. Is it really true that that's Jim Harbaugh's 10th straight loss like that? I mean, there's no way that's possible, right? Like, there's no way that other stat that was floating around last night's also true. The stat being that Rutgers has more bowl wins in the last 20 years than Michigan. I mean, that's got to be a misprint or a prank or a hoax or a joke. I mean, that can't be true, right? I still can't believe that Rutgers stat is true. But I do know this. That's four straight bowl losses for Michigan, which ties Harbaugh with Lloyd Carr for second behind Bo Schembechler for most consecutive bowl losses in Michigan history. This is not the kind of history that Michigan men were hoping for when they brought back this Michigan man. So who's got it better than us?
Who's got it better than us?
Everybody! And when it was over, Nick Saban said that he was looking to make a statement. Normally, a beatdown of Harbaugh and Michigan on New Year's Day would be considered a statement, maybe even a signature win for some programs. But if everybody hammers Harbaugh when it really matters, how much can it really matter? You follow me? The answer is it doesn't. It comes with the territory. Territory being Harbaugh and Michigan are exactly who you want to face on the big stage because they're never ready for it and apparently never will be either. Not when the same thing happens over and over and over again. And it did right there. 1-800-636-8686. Asking them to show up and show out and be ready on the big stage, come to find out, is too much to ask for, Michigan man. And nobody wants to hear you cry about how they punched it in late. Is that what it's come to, Michigan man? You getting hammered on the big stage again and then crying about it afterwards because they piled on? Come on. NCAA Men of March, Chris Beard, is airing tonight at 10:30 p.m. Eastern on CBS Sports Network. Many months went into developing that. He joins us right now. Chris, good to have you on the show. How are you?
Jim, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Chris Beard. Good to have you. So you're 9-3. You've dealt with some injuries. Let me jump right into this. You've won four straight. You beat number one Louisville and MSG. Now you're starting Big 12 play on Saturday against Oklahoma State. Bring me up to date. Let me ask you once again, how is life for you right now, Chris?
Oh, exciting time and love it. You know, Big 12 starts on Saturday. It's going to be another just brutal gauntlet 18-round fight, and we're excited about it. We accomplished a lot in our non-conference. I'm really proud of this team. You know, we lose four starters and basically six of our top seven on the national championship game team last year, but somehow we've kind of scrapped together a team here, got back in the top 25, so I'm proud of this year's team. Looking forward to coaching them.
We're talking Texas Tech basketball. The head coach, Chris Beard, my guest. You know, when you talk about conference play, Chris, I know you're going to battle hard no matter what, but does it feel like there's an intensity shift when you get into conference play? And is it something you have to dial up for, or does everybody just know that it's time to find a new level?
I think it's definitely a different level. You know, you feel it not only with the teams, but the fan bases, the crowds, just the whole, you know, college basketball scene, football closing up, you know, with the bowl games and what have you. And just seems like there's like a shift to college basketball. Our challenge, you know, is with young guys. We're playing five freshmen in our rotation right now. So just making sure they understand it's going to be a different deal come Saturday.
We're talking to Chris Beard. Now, of course, you and I are on CBS Sports Network tonight at 10:30 p.m. with the Men of March special. I've got a number of things from that show and our time together I want to ask you about, but one of the things you said in the special is, quote, when I do my best job coaching is when I have players who have that same grit, that same underdog mentality, that same street dog DNA, end quote. So from the outside, Chris, that win over Louisville sure seemed like an amazing demonstration of that grit and that mentality. Is that the way it felt to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, coaching speak and all this fake stuff would say, well, it was just the next game, but that's just not true. You know, whenever you have a chance to play the number one team in the country in Madison Square Garden on national television in the Jim Valvano game, it's special. So I was proud of our guys that night. We fought, and even if the scoreboard would have been flipped, I would have felt the same way because, you know, we were a little undermanned without our leading scorer. Our backs were against the wall, having lost a couple of games. It's probably the most comfortable I've felt coaching our guys because we're back to kind of the underdog role, and that's kind of where I prefer to be.
We're talking to Chris Beard, Texas Tech head coach. You know, one more thought about that game, too. Avery Benson was an absolute force. He had 10 points. He had four boards. He had a couple of blocks. You said after that game that, quote, Avery is the backbone of our culture. He's in his third year at Texas Tech. He has an Elite Eight ring, a Final Four ring, a Big 12 championship ring, and that's not happenstance. He's a big part of that, end quote. It's really high praise from you. So what does he mean to you and to your team and program?
Oh, Jim, this guy is great, man. I mean, you got to put on your bucket list to have a beer with Avery Benson someday. As soon as he graduates, I'm taking him straight to the bar. It's my kind of guy. He's the first guy we offered a scholarship to when I was in Arkansas, coaching at Arkansas Little Rock. And everything kind of collided where he chose to come and play for us here at Texas Tech. But no disrespect to all the other guys that I've coached over the years, but this guy, pound for pound, is the toughest guy I've ever coached. He's everything that's good about college basketball. He has no desire to even look at individual stats. All he cares about is winning. He's tough. He's just a special guy. And, you know, he's turned into a pretty good basketball player. He's just a redshirt sophomore, so there's going to be a lot of other great memories for him. But to see him out there battling that night and basically help us beat Louisville was big.
We're talking to Chris Beard. I mean, the fact that you called him the toughest guy you've ever coached is really high praise. Now, part of the Men of March show tonight, Chris, includes the preseason trip to the Bahamas. When you have the season that you had last year, and then you go to the Bahamas, it might be pretty easy for guys to kind of get fat, kind of get happy, maybe get soft, but you made the point that fear is a good thing, and you've said that you have all sorts of fear in you. Lay it out for me. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think as a competitor, you know, you're always scared. You're always fearful going into it because you respect the opponent so much. And, you know, in our program, led by our associate head coach, Mark Adams, we study a lot of boxing. Coach Adams is a boxer himself, and I've always enjoyed watching fights and what have you. And I think, you know, some of the greatest fighters ever, they say, hey, man, when I get in that ring, I'm scared to death because I know what the other guy can do. And I think you see it all the time in sports. You know, after a team wins a couple games, there's the let-up game. But whenever a good team drops a few, you know their best effort's going to be out there. So I'm not talking about being soft. I'm not talking about not being prepared. I'm not talking about not being tough. But the idea of fear is one of the biggest motivators any competitor can have.
Texas Tech head basketball coach Chris Beard is joining me. Don't forget, that's going to be on tonight, 10:30 p.m. Eastern on CBS Sports Network. Now, Chris, as people will see in the show tonight, you and your staff put in long hours. I understand that every staff puts in long hours. I think you guys are a different breed. It seems like you and everybody around you genuinely love that work, love that grind. What are those late night sessions like?
Well, they're a lot of fun, actually. I mean, I've never been the big kind of self-promoter guy. I think people talk about how hard they work. I mean, everybody's grinding. There's nobody in BCS basketball. There's nobody in the Big 12. There's nobody that's elite at what they do that's not working. But I think what separates us a little bit is we enjoy doing it. A lot of late nights with our staff, and some of the greatest advice I ever got. We've all heard it before, but you try to find something in life that's not a job; it's a passion. And I really believe that. I mean, I'm one of these guys like yourself. I don't think I've ever really worked a day in my life, as I enjoy what I do and have ever since I started coaching at different levels. And our staffs really feel the same way. So the late nights, the early mornings, the grinded out nights are great. And I found this great kind of ability to kind of enjoy the adversity too. I think a lot of people can enjoy the success. That's kind of easy. But I think when you can kind of enjoy the adversity and fighting through things, it's what makes you alive. I tell our guys all the time, the normal college student goes to school, he has his share of adversity, but he doesn't know what it's like to lose on the buzzer or drop a couple games or overcome adversity. And if you can kind of find, in a sickly competitive way, if you can find enjoyment even in the hard times, I think this is what can, propel you to greatness.
Like adversity is a privilege. I just made that up.
No doubt.
Chris Beard joining us. Liz Cope, Chris, is the executive associate. She says in the show that you're so locked in on basketball that you've lived in your house for 2 years, but you sometimes still ask her what your home address is. It's a pretty amazing story. Is that true?
Unfortunately, that is true. I always get mixed up on the zip codes too, but the other side of that I don't think Liz has experienced with me is, we've moved so many times over the years, I kind of always kind of forget where I am from time to time. But yeah, that is true, unfortunately.
All right, so Chris, speaking of that house, you and I spent some time in that house. You had me in your house. It's an amazing house. Like, when you first got there, did you think to yourself, man, I'm going to get myself a mansion. It's my time. I'm going to get myself a mansion. Was that the thought process?
Absolutely not. I thought I would get an Airstream trailer and put it on a lake or something, but there's no lake in Lubbock. There's one trailer park by the airport that's actually pretty cool. It's got some great trees, but I couldn't get in there. It's got a wait list. It's like ridiculous. Next time you come down to Lubbock, I'll show you. And the house kind of fell in my lap. Tubby Smith, Hall of Fame coach, personal friend, did a great job at Texas Tech building the program. Him and his wife, Donna, sweetest lady in the world. They basically kind of handed off the house to me. So I do have a nice place to stay. I'm very fortunate and blessed. And it's kind of cool thinking I'm living in the same house that Tubby Smith used to live in. That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Now, Chris, the house is amazing, but I want to say that as impressive as that house is, there's something at the facility that I think I was just equally as impressed with. There is a Murphy bed in the facility. It's incredible. How did that come to be? Was that there when you arrived, or did you have that put in?
Got to give Liz credit for that. We've always kind of had an old couch in the corner in our offices and our locker rooms where we've been known to crash for a night or a week from time to time. I think I was kind of not embarrassing, but I was kind of, Liz helped me step up my game. I'll put it that way. So I didn't even know what a Murphy bed was. You remember the old TV show, man, the Bosom Buddies?
The Bosom Buddies, of course.
Yeah, man. Remember, I think they had like one of those beds where it looked like it wasn't a bed and it came out of the wall. So I didn't even know what a Murphy bed was, but Liz showed it to me, and that's one of my best possessions. It's pretty cool. Like the president or the AD or some big donor can be in the office, and he doesn't know that you're sleeping in your office. And then when he leaves, you pull it down. So it's you know, Liz Cope, got to give her credit for that one, too. That was a solid investment.
Oh, that was so good. I mean, that's not like a cot in the office. That is a Murphy bed. I'm familiar with that. I had one of those things once when I came up, too. You see, dude, that's something else you and I have in common. I used to sleep on one of those myself in a tiny studio when I first got my first radio break in San Diego. I love it. Now, when you and I came together in Lubbock, I also had the pleasure of appearing on your show, The Fireside Chat, which was an amazing experience, especially to have a fireside chat, dude, when it was like 120 degrees with no breeze whatsoever. But where did the idea come from for The Fireside Chat, and how much fun do you have doing that?
Have a lot of fun. It's one of the coolest things we've done in our three, now four seasons building the program here. The original idea was to connect with our students, to try to have a direct line of communication with them. So we do the fireside. It's kind of how we get the weekly, monthly information to them. Then it's just kind of spun off, and we've had a lot of fun. We had, actually, Santa Claus was on there around Christmas, did a great job on the fireside. We always enjoy it when former players come back in town. And then certainly having you on there, Jim, was awesome. Here's the life of a coach. You know, you win a big game, you get hundreds of texts. You lose a game, you get like two texts, one from some fan bitching at you and then one maybe from your mom. But the fireside, man, the cell phone was popping the next day. Lots of people impressed that I was able to convince you to be on the show. So you've helped our ratings. Unfortunately, we don't really have any financial incentives for you, but I'll try to get you like a T-shirt or something out your way.
Well, man, there's some things you can't put a price on. I mean, that was amazing. I love that sit down with the fireside chat. I would love to do it again. Now, you also have a practice facility that's coming in. So what's that say about the program and the support, Chris, that you and the program have from the school and the community?
Well, that's tremendous. You know, we have the best athletic director in the country in Kirby Hocutt. I haven't worked for a lot of people, but he's the best. I've been very fortunate to be with some great ones. Basically, Kirby and I share the same vision for Tech basketball, and we have from day one, that we could be relative in the Big 12, we could be competitive, we could compete. Once you do that, you're obviously, you know, able to win the whole thing if you can win the Big 12. And we've really, you know, had some support. Season tickets, all-time high. The practice facility, which we're going to call the Womble, named after my great friend and big-time Tech supporter, Dusty Womble, is going to be a game changer. You saw it going up, Jim. Now it's almost where it's framed, and they're going to start working on the insides. But we're hopeful to be in the Womble, our new practice facility, this summer. Our players are excited about it. Our fans are excited about it. It's just it's one of many great things going on at Texas Tech basketball.
Look for it tonight. NCAA Men of March. The man right there, Chris Beard. He is the subject of this special. It's going to air at 10:30 p.m. Eastern on CBS Sports Network. Hey, Chris, I can't thank you enough. It definitely was one of my favorite things ever. It was great to be in Lubbock. I can't wait to see how it looks tonight. Thank you very much for the access, my man.
You're the best. Talk to you soon.
And it helps you fix them. It's another way the Capital One.
Good night now.